from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio, this is Forum. I'm Scott Schaefer, here today for Michael Krasny. In this hour of Forum, planning your own funeral. The world seems transfixed on eulogizing Michael Jackson. Concerts, memorabilia, TV specials, almost all of it honoring the king of pop. What about the rest of us? How do we want to be remembered? And what kinds of plans do we make to ensure that our funeral reflects our final wishes? Will there be music? And if so, what kind? What about videos or particular readings? Who gets to speak at your funeral and who doesn't? Do we think about these things in advance or just leave it to those left behind? Thinking about funerals, that's our topic, and you're invited to join us. We'll get started with Forum right after this. And welcome back to Forum. I'm Scott Schaefer, here today for Michael Krasny. Well, since Michael Jackson's sudden death last week, the news media have been saturated 24/7 with remembrances and eulogies of the pop star. Plans for a public service are still a little unclear. And in the midst of it all, we started thinking about funerals and how much thought people give to their own funeral and how they want to be remembered after they die. And so we've invited a range of guests to talk with us this hour about how people's lives are remembered and how often those funeral plans are made ahead of time by the deceased. Now, ordinarily, we wait until the bottom of the hour to bring callers into the conversation, but this time we want to hear from you right away. So if you have some thoughts about how you'd like to be remembered, thoughts about planning your own funeral, or maybe you remember a funeral you attended that stands out in your memory, for better or worse, give us a call. 866-733-6786 is the number, 866-733-6786. And as always, you can email us at forum@kqed.org. And joining us first in this hour is Jim Emerson. He is a pastor emeritus of Calvary Presbyterian Church, also past interim president of the San Francisco Theological Seminary. Good to have you with us.
Good to be with you, sir.
Well, how do you talk to people about funerals and how they want to be remembered?
Well, usually by listening, and usually others are the ones who raise it first, and very often it's members of the family rather than the person who is dying. However, wherever it comes, you begin by listening and trying to get a sense of where they're coming from and what they're looking for. Personally, I generally try to look at a service of memorial as a celebration of a life that has been lived, or a celebration of faith.
That differs, I'm sure, given the circumstances of death, right? I mean, a child's death is very different from someone, a grandmother or grandfather who's passed away.
Yes, certainly it is. Certainly it is.
And in those cases, do you give suggestions to people? I mean, you've obviously attended a lot of funerals over the course of your career. How do you counsel people about putting together that last remembrance?
Right. Well, I suggest really three things. The first is that you begin the service with a sense that we're not alone, that we're a part of God and of God's guidance. And then secondly, to be honest about our own sense of inadequacy. Some people might call it a confession of sin, but this isn't a time when you're talking about people's failures. It's just that plain inadequacy that we're suddenly aware of things that we cannot control, that we are not masters of our fate, and we cannot control everything. And then from that to go on into a sense of God's love, and in that context, talking about relevant passages of Scripture and talking about the person who has died, and then finally ending with a sense of commitment of ourselves and of the person to God's care.
You talked about sin, and of course none of us is without sin. To what extent do you think there should be sort of an honesty in a funeral service when you're talking about the deceased in terms of their shortcomings?
Well, I think that when my mother died, for example, my mother was a marvelous person, but I can remember the pastor having said, we need to remember that Edith at times could be a little spicy in her conversation. And everybody knew exactly what was meant. Everybody laughed, and that was good. And then we could move on from that to, but here are the great things we want to remember. So I think a brief acknowledgement, but then focusing on that which we can celebrate.
And the truth can be humorous, right? I mean, even someone's,
yes.
Whether it's their shortcomings, their quirks, their personality, and humor is a good thing. Laughter is a good medicine, right?
It is very good, and I like what you say, too, that we recognize there's something of that in each of us. We're not singling out this person.
Do you think about your own funeral at all?
Yes, I do, but more for a reason that may seem a little different. When my wife, who just died in the last month, as we were approaching that, she said, I want my funeral to be like the funeral you're going to have.
What did that mean?
Oh, my goodness, I better sit down and figure out what I would like. And the fact is, I found it very difficult, and I commend this to others, I found it very difficult to think through her funeral. It was much easier to sit down and think, all right, what would I like in my service and how would I see it? I wrote that out, and then I just transposed the names.
Hmm. And what did you do? How did you frame it?
Well, I framed it with first a sense of trust in that we're all part of a God who is greater than we and wanted the M.O. God, our help in ages past, our hope for years to come. And then I wanted a period of confession in which, nothing morbid, but in a sense of that we are not masters of our fate. We confess that we have limits and that we cannot control everything. And then reading some passages that relate to faith. For me, it came from some came from the Old Testament, the 23rd Psalm, some from the New Testament, the Gospel according to John, which has that phrase, "Let not your heart be troubled." And then, from that on, we had a man sing from the Elijah, "If with all your heart you truly seek him, you will ever surely find him." And we found in my wife's service that really became the turning point emotionally for many, many people. And then several members of the family, well, our three adult children, wanted to speak, so they each did. And I had introduced the whole, but then said I wanted to sit with the family and the rest would be in the hands of the pastor. So I did not speak after that first introduction. And then after that, I had asked the pastor, who was the Laird Stewart at Calvary Presbyterian Church, to talk about what our faith really is. And he did that wonderfully. And out of that, then, we had a prayer for all people. And a final hymn, and then the members of the family escorted the casket out to the hearse.
How often do people express an ambivalence about having a service that's too religious?
That's a very interesting question. I have never had anyone push me on that, but probably it is because in my experience, and I know that of a number of our colleagues, we begin with the question you've asked me. What are you looking for in this service? It's your service, it's your family, and we have things to suggest, but we want to be in your context.
Mm-hmm. So I guess if someone didn't want a pastor to preside, they'd go somewhere else.
Yes, that would be true.
Yeah. Well, I'm going to bring a caller in, if you can stay with us for a few moments.
Surely.
Lori is on the line in Wheeling, Illinois, is it, Lori?
Yes, it's Wheeling, Illinois.
Hi. Well, good morning, and thanks for joining us.
Hi. I just had a really brief story. The daughter of the father, rather, of my daughter, who was age 44 this past January, passed away suddenly. And his mom had died suddenly 2 months before that. And we are in the Chicago suburbs, and his body was shipped down to Birmingham by his mother's family. So the pastor did not know the person that died, never seen him before. And during the service, he says, well, this is a Baptist church in Birmingham. He says, oh, I don't know if he's going to heaven or not. And for me and my mom to sit there with my 16-year-old daughter, who just suddenly lost her father, it was just unbelievable.
Mm. Did you protest afterwards?
You know, there had been so many issues and problems since the death had occurred the week before. And he was never married, so there was no one to, like, go to, and the anchor person had been his mom. We just wanted to get out of there after the burial. We just wanted to get out of there as soon as possible because there were a lot of ill feelings and funeral preparations and a lot of things done that shouldn't have been done. But, again, he died suddenly at age 44, So there were no plans made.
Yeah.
Whatsoever.
Jim Emerson, what are your thoughts about that? I've also been to funerals where the person presiding didn't at all know the person. And it does have an impersonal feeling, if not, in Lori's case, downright insulting sometimes.
Well, yes, and I've also been to a couple of where there was an altar call, which I think is totally inappropriate.
Tell us what that is.
Oh, an altar call, thank you. An altar call is when the minister will go on from what Lori was saying and say, well, if this person didn't come to Jesus, you don't need to make that same mistake. So will you? I invite you now to come to Jesus and put up your hand and so forth and so on. Which is really taking, from my standpoint, is taking a very personal, a very serious moment and situation and manipulating it for somebody else's purpose, not for the purpose of dealing with the family and honoring the person who has died.
Lori, I wonder if that experience got you thinking about your own funeral and how you might plan for that to avoid that sort of thing happening to you.
It actually did, and just to emphasize what your guest just said, that exactly happened. The pastor proceeded to have a church sermon for another 45 minutes, and it was all I could do to just sit there and be calm for my daughter's sake. But yes, it definitely gave my husband and myself a lot of time to think, and we are actually trying to, once I get to all of the estate things with my daughter's father, we are going to make sure that we have all of our eggs in a row, funeral arrangements and living will and everything, because none of that was done. And to this day, I am still trying to get this person's estate open. And he died on January 23rd of this year, and I'm still trying to get the estate open. So, yes, I have a 16-year-old stepdaughter as well. And my husband and I, are working right now on plans to make sure they don't have to go through anything like what I'm dealing with.
Right. Well, Lori, thanks so much for sharing that with us. And it's really a cautionary note for people to, if you don't make plans, somebody will make plans for you. So it's always good to think ahead, I guess. Jim Emerson, I want to thank you for joining us this hour, and good luck to you as well.
Well, thank you very much, and I appreciate your program.
All right. Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Well, I want to bring in another guest now. Todd Inouye is someone who works at iTunes in the promotions department. And we first heard from Todd on the California Report, our statewide program, and he did a commentary for us a few months back. And Todd Inouye, thank you for joining us this morning.
Morning, Scott.
Just to fill people in, you did a commentary a few months back about music for funerals, in particular a funeral for your aunt Jean. Tell us a little bit about her and what happened.
Like you were saying, that music is always one of those. It's just one of those last details left to the, last minute. If you don't plan for it, they were just going to fill in the blanks. So, when my aunt passed away in September, everybody knew that I was a music fanatic. So they thought I would be a good person to put together a list. But it turned out to be a lot more complicated because I think the expectation was for me to choose a bunch of boring, normal Bette Midler type of songs like Wind Beneath My Wings. And when that actually got brought up by my mom to include that, I said, no way, I'm putting my foot down, because I just didn't want something so sentimental and so incredibly maudlin to be playing. I mean, some people might like it, and it might work for some people, but for me, it's just so typical.
So they asked you to put together the music, but you laid down some ground rules.
Yeah, definitely. One of them was no Wind Beneath My Wings, no Celine Dion, no Sarah McLachlan, none of that stuff. I wanted something to honor my aunt's legacy without having everyone think about their own mortality. And so I wanted to invoke the good things about life, and without beating people over the head with it.
And so did you have trouble separating your own musical tastes from the rest of your family? I mean, were you trying to make something, choose songs that were meaningful to you or to them, or to honor your aunt's legacy, or all those things? That sounds like
it was definitely about honoring my aunt's legacy. But at the same time, I mean, they definitely wanted something that people would want to listen to, but at the same time, they didn't want to be completely bum everybody out. So, for instance, I chose My Song by Labi Siffre, who is a British singer from the 70s. I liked it because there's a metaphor of how a memory of a person is invoked every time you sing a song.
Let's listen to a little bit of that.
This is my song, and no one can take it away. It's been so long, but now you're here, here to stay. And I wonder if you know what it means to find your dreams come true.
And Todd Inouye, how did you choose that song, and what reaction did it get?
I first heard the song from a Kanye West record called I Wonder, and I liked the meaning in the song, and I just remember it's sampled in there, and I went to the source, and I just found the song, Labi Siffre's version, the original version, to be so compelling and profound. As for the reaction, I think people were just too caught up in the moment to really appreciate the things, except for maybe my brother, who's sort of a music nerd like me.
And afterwards, did people say, hey, Todd, nice job. Would you do that for my funeral?
No, but one thing that happened was my aunt is Buddhist, and it was at a Buddhist church in Berkeley. And the sensei, who was a younger guy, he mentioned that he recognized a lot of the songs that was playing in the mix. I mean, there was also things like Close to Me by Jake Shimabukuro, which is a cover of a Carpenter song. He also noticed Tiny Dancer by Elton John, You've Got a Friend by Carole King. And he mentioned that it was an indication of how the generations are changing, whereas before the music would just be some really boring classical music, and how nobody would speak at the funerals because they wanted to keep their emotions to themselves. And the fact that he can recognize some of these songs, it just showed that the generations are becoming more open to new things.
All right. Well, Todd Inouye, thank you so much for sharing the song list that you chose for your aunt. And I'm sure it got a lot of people thinking about music they want to have played at their own funeral. Thank you for joining us.
Sure.
And let's go to the phones now. And again, the number to call if you want to share your thoughts about how you want to be remembered, 866-733-6786, 866-733-6786. And Andy is on the line in San Francisco. Hi, Andy.
Hi. I actually have this discussion reminded me of a thing from the Odd Couple TV show, where I don't remember exactly what the context is, but Felix is talking to Oscar about what he wants for his funeral. And I looked up the quote. I'm just going to read it. So Felix says, "You know what I would like? I would like a regimental flag draped across my coffin. And hope this isn't pretentious, I'd like it drawn by a team of white horses while the band plays the Grand March from Aida, because that's my favorite opera. I'd like it to go around and around the cemetery three times." And then he turns to Oscar and says, "What would you like?" And Oscar says, "I'd like to be there."
Yeah, he wants to get there. Yeah, they had that fun back and forth with each other, and he wanted Felix to go first.
Yeah, well, I share that.
Thank you. Thanks very much for the call. Well, speaking of Hollywood, or at least the television industry, we've got somebody joining us now who works down there in Los Angeles, Lynn Eisenberg, who's founder and CEO of Lights Out Enterprises. She's also author of the Funeral Planner Trilogy, a series of novels. And Lynn, good to have you with us.
Hi, thank you for having me.
So tell us, you are down there, and first of all, what are your thoughts? You're just seeing all this craziness, really, around Michael Jackson's funeral. What are your thoughts about that?
Wow, well, he's an icon. He's a major icon, is and was an icon, and I just hope that it doesn't turn into a complete circus. That
isn't it a little late
a lot
for that?
More. Yeah, it's a little late for that, but they haven't had the public memorial yet, and they will, and it'll be an outpouring and an opportunity for people around the world to express their grief and honor his what he brought forth to the world in terms of his talents and skills.
And if they hired you and asked you to plan the funeral, what would you do?
Well, for one thing, I'd probably have it at the Rose Bowl, which is where he put on the big event for the Super Bowl, and so I think it would be a great place to have it, have a big event there. There's an opportunity where everybody could come and participate, and I think that's a key thing in today's world of modern grief, if you will, is participation. I think it's key. People want to feel that they're participating and that there's an element of interaction, so I think that would be a great location for it and a practical location. I think also what would be great is to tie it in with it, some of his charity, like Heal the World, and tying in with that, having video monitors all over the stadium showing his videos that he's done throughout his life playing. I think there should be something that, with the theme of black and white, that wonderful song that he did, that would also show that he was all about beyond the transcendence of black and white and into color. And I think that would be another way to go. I think everybody should have an opportunity to speak. There are so many people that loved him, and I think it should be limited in time. I think everyone should have an opportunity and keep it to about 60 seconds so that they honor him, and you take that time to make sure that it's not about self-promotion with other people getting up there and promoting and having other ulterior motives to promote agenda they may have.
How do you think about, for your clients, I understand you use video a fair amount in the services that you help plan. Tell us about that. How do you integrate that?
Well, I work with my clients where I plan ahead, and we create tribute videos of a narrative nature. So it's really about the essence of who they are. And depending on what they want, we'll bring in Hollywood talent to act with them or to be part of the ceremony as an MC. And so we use the videos as a way to celebrate the life and the essence of who they are. We show it at the ceremony, and it's also what I call pre-purposed content because it can be used for other events ahead of the life celebration, where, i.e., a 60th birthday party and so forth. So it can be shared in that way, and it also can be used as a legacy for one's family and grandchildren and so forth.
I imagine you've had some more unusual ceremonies. What are some of those that come to mind?
Well, one of my clients, for instance, he's a real estate investor and agent, and we did a tribute video for him where we had – he always wanted to be an actor, so we had real actors come in and act with him in the script. And then he's also a big scuba diving fanatic, so one of the things that we planned for him is that his life celebration will take place on a cruise ship around his favorite island where people can take turns scuba diving in honor of his memory. So that's an example of one thing we've planned. Another client is a major golf fanatic. So what we've done is created a ceremony that would take place at a golf course, and everybody would take turns teeing off with name-engraved glow-in-the-dark golf balls that say his name on them, and it would be a simultaneous tee-off at midnight, and the sky will be a Twitter with these glow-in-the-dark golf balls in memory of his love.
And you did one at a disco, yeah. I understand, also.
Oh, yeah. One of my clients wanted to have her life celebration on top of a mountain in Malibu as a disco party, and everybody to come dressed up in disco clothes and dance and celebrate while she's alive. She didn't want to wait until the end. She wanted to celebrate with everybody in her life while she was alive and well.
All right. Lynn Eisenberg, founder and CEO of Lights Out Enterprises. We're talking this hour about funerals and planning ahead for your own funeral. What would you like to have happen, be said, and the kind of music that would be heard, maybe a video at your funeral? Let us know. 866-733-6786 is the number to call. And the email is forum@kqed.org. Stay with us. Lots more to talk about in this hour of Forum. And welcome back to Forum. Scott Schaefer here today for Michael Krasny. In this hour, in light of all the hoopla and frenzy around Michael Jackson's death and plans for his funeral, we're talking about funerals and how people want to be remembered and funerals perhaps you've gone to that stick out in your mind. Give us a call at 866-733-6786. Let's go to the phones now. Lisa is on the line in San Mateo. Hi, Lisa.
Hi. I just wanted to say two things. First off, I'd love to have a big old party after I'm gone and just for everyone to have a good time. But I also think it's important to remember that funerals are for the people who are still left. It's not for the person who's died. The person who's died is gone. And it's for the people. I think you should just let people plan whatever they want to plan. I probably wouldn't prefer to have a religious ceremony, but my parents would definitely feel a lot better if they could have a religious ceremony for me. And I don't care because it doesn't really matter to me because I'm gone.
Hmm. Well, that's big of you. You're willing to sort of set aside the things that are important to you to let those who are left behind grieve in a way that makes them feel better.
Right, because, I mean, let's be honest, nobody really knows what happens to us when we're gone. And I like to think that we just come back in another form, and death is merely a transition to another life. So there's not much point in trying to remember a life that's gone. You're living in the past in that respect, and you should just, you know, look to the future.
What if there are people, though, left behind who disagree about what they should do for the funeral?
That's up to them to decide.
It's their problem, huh?
It's their problem. They've got, and that's important for them to work out amongst themselves. I think a funeral is really also an emotional healing opportunity, and for families to come together who may be in disagreement. And yeah, if I were to plan things out, that'd be a lot easier on them. But then they're not going to address the issues that they have to address, and they're the ones who are still living, so they're the ones who have to live with themselves.
Have you had to participate in the planning of someone else's funeral before? And how was that?
It was fine. I've had grandparents who passed, and my one grandmother who I was really close to, we planned her funeral, and we went through her Bible and pulled out the passages that were the most, you could tell were the most read, the pages that were the most ragged, and also in her hymnal, we knew all of her songs, and I played a lot of them on my guitar for her at the memorial, and we made a point for everyone to participate as much as they could and to talk about a memory that they had to share their own thoughts.
Yeah, well, that's in clearly a case of making a service very personal and human, which is not always the case with funerals. But Lisa, thanks so much for the call. Let's go to now Vernon is in Oakland. Vernon, hi.
Hi. I just wanted to share my experience with my dad's death. He died kind of suddenly, and we didn't have any plans. But he was a Catholic, so we called his local priest, which is St. Jerome's at St. Jerome's in El Cerrito, and he told us to bring some flowers and a picture, and we just got a bunch of people together, and we kind of all sat around in a circle with the priest moderating, and the priest gave a nice speech about the mystery of death and so on, and we just all shared our thoughts about him, and there was a shedding of emotion and some wonderful testimony, it was very cathartic and very profound for me. I think it was the right thing to do. Very simple and not involved, but very, very deep. And I just wanted to give that. It doesn't have to be a big to-do.
Yeah, so keep it simple, and that would work. Consider to get you thinking about your own funeral a little bit?
Yeah, as a matter of fact, I would very much like to have something like that. Just heartfelt sentiment. Expressed emotion, you know, the kind of emotions that come up at that time, it's good for the people involved, I think. And it certainly was great for me, and if I can imagine myself, you know, watching them do this, I think I would be pretty satisfied.
All right. Well, Vernon, thanks so much for sharing that, and appreciate the call. Let's go now to Petaluma, and Weld is on the line. Good morning.
Hi. I am president of a funeral society here affiliated with the Funeral Consumers Alliance. And we help guide people to avoid, we emphasize, let me start off, I say it differently. We emphasize the difference between a funeral and a memorial service. A memorial service, the body is not present. Most people haven't planned for what they want done to, for, or with their bodies, whether they want to be cremated, whether they want a green burial, or whether they want a full-fledged funeral that typically can cost more than an automobile.
Well, and you raise a good point that the funeral and the memorial service can be separate. And more and more, I seem to notice people having those memorial services a few weeks after the person dies and has been buried or cremated, just to give them more time to think about it, maybe some time to let some of the grief dissipate as well.
Yes, and your earlier caller who spoke about music interested me too, because when Mother passed on, she had made clear that what she wanted was Beethoven's Sixth, and that was the music that was played at her memorial service. She died in Lancaster County, Pennsylvania, in the midst of a very religious community. The neighbors who came in had never been to a memorial service that wasn't presided over by a minister. Dad did the service, and it worked beautifully, and it worked beautifully for the neighbors as well, and they all remembered Mother favorably, and the whole thing went very well indeed.
All right. Well, Weld, I appreciate the call, and again, good reminder that if you want something done at your funeral or done a particular way, you got to write it down or tell people who are around while you're still alive. Let's go to the phones now, and Claire Noland is joining us from Los Angeles. She is a editor with the LA Times, deputy obituary editor. And Claire Noland, good to have you with us.
Hi, Scott.
So tell us, it's always, for those who don't know the way the newspaper business works, it may be impressive when the day after somebody dies, there's a huge obituary that's there. And it seems like, wow, how did they do all that work in such a short time? And of course, that's not generally the case. These things sort of sit on the shelf, don't they, in many cases?
No, it's magic. No, we try to prepare for prominent figures to write their stories in advance. If we hear that someone is in ill health, that sort of thing, because you generally only have a short amount of time and often a short amount of space to sum up a person's life, and that's really challenging, and we're trying to provide a complete picture. And so if you know that someone is ill, you want to get a head start on it so that you can give the best picture that you can of this person's life.
So in the case of...
You don't want to have to only do Michael Jackson in a few hours.
So is that a case where you did have an obit sitting there waiting?
We did.
Yeah. And so obviously he wasn't sick. Why do you choose just people who are so big and famous that you just have to do it just in case?
Right. We have usually it's because someone is we hear that they're ill. But we also have some stories in various stages of preparation, just because of their prominence, because you know you don't want to have to do it on deadline. You want to have a head start at least.
And do you interview the person themselves?
I don't know that anyone that we work with generally does that. I have heard that there are some obituary writers who do that, but I personally don't know anyone who has.
I heard a story years ago, and it's apocryphal, about Bette Davis. And the story was that a reporter came to interview her about her life. And halfway through the interview, she realized that she asked, is this for my obituary? Mm-hmm. And the writer acknowledged that it was. And she said, well, wait just 1 minute. And she came back a couple minutes later with some martinis and sat down and said, okay, now I'm ready.
Right.
You know, she wanted, in a sense, you know, settling scores and getting the last word in.
Right.
Do you think that kind of you're saying really that thing probably doesn't really happen, that you pull quotes from other stories perhaps, but you don't interview them specifically for that story, for the obit?
Right. I don't think that most people are comfortable talking about themselves in that context, because I think that they don't want to stop and consider that they will be dying soon.
Yeah. Well, let's stay with us, if you will. We're going to take a call here from Pam in Mill Valley. Pam, welcome to the program.
Hi.
Go ahead.
Well, I work with people, seniors mostly, who are interested in leaving a written legacy of their lives. So I do work with people who are indeed interested in reflection and memory and kind of getting it down in writing. So that they do have this written legacy. It's too bad we call it obituaries, because it's really you know, not about death at all, to the people who attend these workshops, at least, or to the seniors that I work with. It's about their lives and celebration, which kind of goes with what everyone's been saying about funerals.
And so you help them. You help them write their own obits.
I do.
How do they? How do you? How do you help them?
I do that for them. It turns out it's the biggest gift for the family after they do pass. I mean, mostly my clients are perfectly healthy. So what we do is we just talk about, you know, their background, their lives, how they want to be remembered. I'm a former journalist. I used to work a correspondent at Newsweek magazine, and I know how to get people to talk about their lives. It's kind of what I do best, and it's kind of what people do best, talking about themselves. And we, I come away with a really good sense of what should be included in their obituaries. It's hard to talk about, really, because people do think it's such a negative thing, but thinking about their own death. But again, it's really thinking about your life.
Right. And as you point out, Pam, it's the hardest thing to do is to write an obit the day of or after or even in the days following somebody's death.
Oh, my gosh. The families afterwards are... Sorry, I'm calling from my house. My dog, Duncan, is barking. The families are the ones that are happiest afterwards because you don't have to, you know, in your grief, try to pull together what your father meant to you. I mean, you can do it through anecdotes briefly. And leaving behind these, what I usually do is have people try to get it down into 5 paragraphs.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Well, Pam, thanks for the call. And Claire Noland, that first sentence in an obit in a newspaper is interesting. And I remember when Bill Clinton left office, there was talk about no matter what he does the rest of his life, that first sentence of his obit is going to mention impeachment and a reference to a sex scandal. How do you decide what goes in that first sentence?
Well, you do have to distill their life into a short segment, and we are trying to be fair, and we are trying to give the totality of their life in a short amount of space. So, yeah, I don't think Bill Clinton is going to get away with that. I mean, or away from that, in the same way that President Nixon, you know, wasn't going to get away from Watergate, regardless of how he tried to rehabilitate his image after his presidency. So it's just the way it is that there are only going to be one or two things that really stand out at the end of someone's life, and we have to choose and decide and figure out what's the best reflection of their character.
And how many obits would you say the LA Times has waiting on the show?
Oh, I don't know a particular number. There are
hundreds.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Well, thanks for joining us, Claire Noland from the Los Angeles Times. Good to have you with us this hour. And let's go to the phones now. Karen is on the line in San Jose. Hi, Karen.
Hi, Scott. I was just calling to share a biracial perspective. Mm-hmm. My mom is Vietnamese and my dad is German and Czechoslovakian.
Mm-hmm.
And the ways in which both sides of my family grieve and bury our dead are very different. And I know that we've lost a lot of people on my mom's side, and most of the ceremonies are in Vietnamese, and we stay until the dirt covers the grave completely because there was a lot of grave robbing in Vietnam, and it's just kind of become a tradition, and my family members will take a lot of pictures and video of open caskets and things that the other side of my family would think are mortifying, you know? And so I've talked to my mom a lot about what she would want because she identifies with both communities. And, you know, for instance, does she want to be buried in the Vietnamese part of this Catholic cemetery with her loved ones, or does she want to be near my dad, who's white? Or, you know, those kind of considerations.
Yeah. And, what does she say about that?
You know, she says that she trusts God, and she gets really uncomfortable. And when I push, she says, you know, I don't think I should have to plan this. And I've tried to rationalize with her and say, you know, that's fine, but you'd really help out me and my siblings if you could give us some direction in terms of what you want, ranging from do not resuscitate orders to, you know, burial arrangements. And I think there's a lot of cultural stigma around it, and she gets really, really uncomfortable.
Yeah. Well, it does raise the point that there different cultures approach these things in very different ways, including some thinking it's bad luck to even think about it or talk about it.
Absolutely.
So how would you then, how do you resolve that question of doing something for your mother versus doing it for those left behind? And because it may not be the same thing.
You know, since I think the most respectful thing I could do for her in that circumstance was to check in with her older sibling, because I know that birth order is very important. And then to check in with my dad if he was still living at that point and just try to reach a compromise, because I think what she would ultimately want is for everyone to get along, basically, and to have everything, you know, in life, harmony is very important to her. So I imagine in death that would be accurate as well.
All right. Well, Karen, thanks so much for joining us and sharing that with us. Joining us now is Jennifer Block. She's Education Director and Chaplain at the Zen Hospice Project in San Francisco. Jennifer Block, welcome.
Thank you.
I'm wondering if you were just listening to Karen and this notion of, you know, having a family with mixed cultures. How do you approach that kind of thing when, you know, the folks are of different religions?
It's tricky territory, and we have to be very careful. I would agree with the last caller that it's important not to push. I think the progress that hospice has brought to our culture is that people have choices now. Once upon a time, people didn't even think twice about what would be done or what wouldn't be done. With our multicultural community here in San Francisco, we do have to ask people sometimes together and sometimes separately. For instance, with a ethnically Chinese family, some people will not even mention the fact that their father or their grandfather, the patriarch, is dying, let alone do some planning. And the father will say to me, "Don't tell my family that I'm dying." And then I go out to the living room and they say, "Don't tell our father that he's dying." Mm. So I'm actually having two conversations at once, and usually some planning can evolve from that, but it definitely takes some time and a lot of respect for people's culture.
And how do you find that people resolve this question of whether they want a service that basically is the kind of service they would want if they were in the audience versus the ones that the people left behind would want and the kind of thing they would plan?
I think an ideal funeral memorial combines the both. For some people, just the fact that there is a funeral and a memorial is the most important thing. We serve a lot of people who are underserved or homeless, and they don't even mind being remembered by strangers. They just want to be remembered.
Mm-hmm.
In terms of the debate between family members, again, we proceed cautiously, and I think the fact that something happens is more important than whether it's for the living or the person who's passed.
Yeah. And what about values and a sense of humor, spirituality, those kinds of things? Those all go into the mix, I imagine.
They do, and this is something that a lot of people are planning for or including along with their money and property and health care, is something called an ethical will. And this is where a person will write out what their values are, what lessons they have learned in life, their hopes for the future, for their children and their communities. And a lot of people are doing this because they think these are what's most important to us. These are the matters of the heart and perhaps more long-lasting than one's property.
Can you think of an example of that that stands out in your mind?
I can think of a family where a man was disabled and living alone for a very long time and didn't have any actual blood family nearby. And the hospice community that we built around him at Zen Hospice, we actually became his brothers and his sisters and his parents over the year that we took care of him and helped him actually record his life story to be passed on and shared in our community, which was a really beautiful thing. And he talked about where he was born, what his life was like as an African-American in the South in the 50s and 60s. So we actually became carriers of his story after his death.
Hmm. Do you find that baby boomers are wanting to have more control over their services than people of earlier generations?
Most definitely. They want control over the medical care, how they die, and in some ways can be a hand from the grave reaching into what happens next. I also think baby boomers are really concerned about caring for their own parents. So we have people in their 40s and 50s who are now what are called tweeners. They're caring for children, and they're caring for their parents. And so there's a lot to learn and do for both of those people that the baby boomers are seen as providers for.
And in many ways, that's a good thing, though, that people are thinking about it. They may maybe go too far and try to control things, hand from the grave, as you say. But in general, I would say our culture has avoided talking about it for many, many decades and centuries.
I agree, and we're making great progress in having the conversations while we're alive. so there can be less suffering and more ease in what's a very difficult time for people.
All right, Jennifer Block, Education Director and Chaplain at the Zen Hospice Project in San Francisco. Thanks for joining us.
My pleasure.
And let's go back to the phones now again. The number to call, 866-733-6786. And Thea is on the line in Santa Rosa. Hi there.
Hi. Great show. Very interesting. I wanted to present something real quick that I just experienced about a month ago. I had a dear old friend die. He died a month ago, and he died of cancer, and everyone knew it was coming. And he was a well-known person in the Bay Area and had a lot of friends, was involved in with a lot of music. So what we did was we had a kind of a living memorial. While he was still around, he was in a hospice care, and they opened their doors to it, and about 100 people came, and we had a party with him. He was in a wheelchair, and people played music and danced, and we all brought food, and it was a nice celebration with him, and there was no denying, you know, that he was moving on, but I have to say it gave me some closure. There's going to be a memorial for him this weekend, but
I can tell it still brings up a lot of emotion for you.
Yeah, but yeah. It was really more of a joyful celebration.
And how nice that he got to hear all the great things his
friends
absolutely. Had to say.
Oh, absolutely. And he was to the point where he couldn't, you know, he was limited in his interaction. But I think it was a great way to remember and honor somebody's life and be in their presence one more time.
All right, Thea, thanks very much for the call. Let's go now to Sue, who's calling from San Antonio, Texas. Hi, Sue. Welcome to the program.
Hi, Scott. Can you hear me?
Yes, go right ahead.
Yeah, I am actually very thankful that you're having this program, and I've learned things already from the previous callers and some of your guests. But the one thing that I wanted to bring up is that I have a husband who's 47, and he is a cancer patient. And with that, we've been able to open up discussions, as difficult as it may be, about both of us and what our wants are, which would be something we hadn't thought about prior to his diagnosis.
What's that?
And being able to talk more about funeral planning and what our wants are for that. And in finding out that one of the big things for us is that we're very much into environmental causes, and my husband is making choices that are, you know, green burial, what's available. He learned a lot about that, and he was surprised that in his home state of Iowa, he was under the impression that he wouldn't be able to do these things. And once we actually investigated it, we found out that in most states, in fact, all but five states, things like embalming, things like being put into a traditional casket and all that is not required. You do have choices of choosing different and alternative green burial, and I think it's real important for people to know that.
Do you have any concern that that's a somewhat non-traditional? It's much more common in places like the Bay Area than you're calling from Texas, but you say this would be in Iowa, right?
Right.
So, do you have any concern that you know, people might think it's odd, or is that just not of a concern to you?
It is a concern, and even to take that further, part of what has stemmed this beyond our interest in environmental causes is the fact that my husband's family, actually, on his mother's side, his mother's brother is a funeral director. And the family thus far has been under the guise that they all have to go to his uncle in the end. And thus far, this really will break from the family tradition of, you know, having this all handled by them. And he's been turned off by this whole part of, you know, his family's livelihood for most of his life, from the time he was a child. And so while it's not well documented in areas in the Midwest, it's becoming more known. In fact, in Iowa, the Trappist monks build actually natural coffins for people.
Hmm.
Well, and
Sue, we're short on time. I'm sorry to interrupt you, but I appreciate your talking about that. I'm sure it'll get a lot of people thinking about that sort of option for themselves and for their loved ones. Thanks for the call.
Thank you.
Let's go now to Jean. We'll get one more call in here, maybe. Jean from San Francisco. Good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for taking my call. The thing that's concerning me is the cost of funerals. Sort of like my friends got married, and when they got married, they had a small ceremony, and then they had a small reception, and they took the money, and they put it into their first condo. I relate that to funerals the same way as that it's costing too much. And the woman from Los Angeles who wants to do this big thing for Michael Jackson, I can understand that. But funerals, that's just ridiculous to spend that kind of money on something like that. I know some people can't afford that. But that should be a party that they have and not be considered a funeral. And other people, you know, it's just your death. And like the one lady said who was talking about her mother didn't want to talk about it, some people just simply want to pass away and have whatever the people who are left behind say, let them say it, and then it's done.
Yeah, and the woman who just called from Texas as well, sort of not wanting to go the traditional route of the family funeral parlor, which is, as you said, very, very expensive.
Yes, the expense is ridiculous. And then, like with weddings, then, you know, 50% of the weddings are not, you know, it ends up in divorce. I'm not equating that to death, but I'm just saying that that's just a burden at the end of a lot of people's lives. And yeah, I know a lot of people have plans where they actually pay into things so that by the time their death comes, it's taken care of. But that's just a concern that how ridiculous to worry at the end for the cost of something.
Yep,
like
it's a very real cost. And very real concern. Jean, thanks for calling us. Thanks to everyone for sharing very intimate thoughts about their own funerals and their loved ones. And thanks to all of our guests, Todd Inouye, Lynn Eisenberg, Claire Nolan from the Los Angeles Times, Jennifer Block from the Zen Hospice Project, and at the top of the hour, Jim Emerson. Forum is produced by Tina Lauerberg and Judy Campbell and Kevin Guillory. Our senior editor is Dan Zoll. Forum's executive producer is Raul Ramirez. Our engineer today is Howard Gelman. I'm Scott Schaefer, in for Michael Krasny. Dave Iverson will be here tomorrow, and then Michael returns next week. Thanks so much for listening.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Claude and Louise Rosenberg Jr. Family Foundation.